Welcome to the show that gets Christians thinking about faith and politics. Get ready to challenge the status quo, expand your imagination, and tackle controversy head on. Let's stand together at the intersection of faith and freedom. It's time for the Libertarian Christian Podcast.
All right, welcome to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast, a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute. I'm your host, Doug Stewart, and if you're watching on YouTube, you will see that I have Cody Cook and Alex Bernardo on with me. Hey, fellas, how you doing?
we're so polite that we always sort of give the other person the initiative. I'm doing well. How are you doing, Alex?
Oh, I'm doing great, Cody. Good to hear from you. Yes, you're a gentleman. Thank you for that.
You guys were just so nice. Nobody decided to go. It's like the people at the four-way stop were like, everybody's, no, you go. No, you go. It's like, do you know what flash your lights mean? It's like, I meant for you to go.
Or it's like Christians at a potluck, you know, no one wants to be the first one to go because it looks greedy.
Yeah. I don't know. Most Christians are pretty hungry, in my experience. There's never have a problem in my church about that.
Well, one of us has to have some Donald Trump energy and just jump in the front.
That's right.
Yeah, right. There you go. Yeah. Well, if you've clicked on this video, you probably already know what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about the books we've been reading lately. This is kind of an LCI tradition where we talk to each other about some of the books we've been reading and share with you our findings, why we want you to consider reading them. Sometimes we've actually done episodes with interviews with some of the guests. So in any case, we're going to start off with some of the non-faith books that we've been consuming. And Cody, since you don't read very many non-faith books, I'm going to let you go first with your one selection of, non-Christian reading.
Yeah, Matt, I read libertarian books and stuff. But yeah, when we were putting this list together, I was thinking about kind of what I'd really recommend, like things that kind of blew my mind this year. And most of those were kind of in the theological arena. So the one exception would be Coleman Hughes' The End of Race Politics. In it, he argues basically for the idea that colorblind policies are actually a good thing. And this is kind of in this era that we're in right now where colorblindness is seen as racist because it doesn't sort of explicitly privilege people of color. And Hughes essentially argues that privileging one race over another, even if it is people of color, qualifies as racism, which he calls sort of neo-racism. It's just a different kind of...
He uses that word throughout the book to describe what a lot of people call anti-racist.
Yes, exactly. Yep. Yeah, and this is one book that I think we both read this year, Doug. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's one that Alex checked out, but we both looked at this one. So one thing that kind of stuck out to me that's sort of been interesting, just because of my sort of interest in kind of media theory and media criticism, is that he highlights this data that shows that both Black and white Americans believed that race relations were steadily improving up until about 2013, and then suddenly everything goes south. And his argument is like, well, nothing really like changed in the data. Like there's not like you had this sort of, you know, huge increase in police brutality or something like that. Obama was president and was popularly elected. And, but really what he kind of blames on it is this, this kind of explosion of social media and smartphones, becoming just very widely received, very mainstream. And that gave us sort of an exaggerated sense of racial issues. And certainly an exaggerated sense of all kinds of issues. And so that's one little piece that's really interesting, but largely the book is arguing for colorblindness as kind of a policy position.
Alex, I like it. What did you read, man?
Well, you know, I read a book over the summer. I did a lot of libertarian reading. It's been all biblical studies ever since then, but I read one of Cody Cook's favorite authors, Hans Hermann Hoppe.
Sarcasm.
Yeah, it was very much sarcastic. But he has a book that was published, I think in the year I was born, 1989, called A Theory of Capitalism and Socialism. And in that book, he tries to provide both a philosophical and a moral foundation for capitalism as a form of property rights. And the book is absolutely incredible as a work of political theory. And he essentially argues that even if we had, and he uses the phrase an Edenic state where we didn't have to worry about natural scarcity, every single human being is in and of itself, or is in and of themselves a scarce resource, because there's only one of them. And the time that that human being exerts is scarce, because once you have utilized your time, you cannot get that time back. And so he argues that even in a world of superabundance, you would still have to have property rights, the property being your time and then your body. And he's able to deduce from that the entire libertarian theory of property rights within that moral framework of you own your body, you own your time, and no one else can take that away from you. And it's a brilliant analysis of property rights based on that idea. And he does a great job of, I think, undermining some of not just the economic, but also the moral presuppositions that many political philosophers have relating to socialism. And I think that it's just a very, very intelligent critique of that within the Rothbardian, Misesian tradition. I couldn't recommend it enough. It's a little technical in some places, but it's definitely well worth the read.
You also read about Ethics of Money Production, right?
Yes. And I cannot pronounce the guy's first name, but his last name is Huelsman. That's another...
Guido is, I think.
Yes. That's it.
You know, it's a good book on economics if you can't pronounce the guy's name.
Yes, absolutely. And I believe that he's French and he's Catholic. And so in the Ethics of Money Production, he just talks about what it looks like to artificially expand the money supply and how people have generally handled that throughout, I guess, the Western Christian tradition. And he argues that the theory that artificially inflating the money supply is morally wrong goes back to a thinker in the 13th century or the 14th century rather, Nicholas Oresme, who made the claim that, again, if people are holding this money and there's somebody else who's debasing the currency and that devalues the currency that these other people currently hold, then that can't be morally sustainable. And so he just works that out and kind of looks at how when societies debase their currency, it winds up hurting people that are trying to save and be responsible, and that that's unethical and that we should reject it. So another very excellent book on economics.
Well, was it real quick on we moved past Hoppe before I could start an argument with Alex. I like a lot of what Hoppe has to say. Hoppe is one of those guys that you sort of, it's like, if you had like a racist uncle, but who was also like really smart, and you like could sit and listen to him at like Thanksgiving and like, oh, it's really smart. And then suddenly he's like, we got to keep all the gays out. It's like, okay, well, wait, where'd that come from? That's kind of how I feel reading Hoppe. I actually really appreciated a lot of Stefan Kinsella's work, who's kind of a disciple of Hoppe, but maybe a little less racist uncle-y, I guess, in some ways. But his
just making up words here.
No, I get what you're saying.
Yeah. And in particular, I really appreciated what Kinsella has done on, actually, he just put together a view on kind of law and libertarian society as well, this giant book that I haven't read yet. But his stuff on intellectual property is really fascinating, because his primary argument is that the reason we have laws is that basically there are scarce resources. Basically, anything that you're going to have conflict over, you have to have rules about how it's going to be used.
Yes.
So, and intellectual ideas are not scarce. So, you know, if you know, a caveman named Ugg sees his neighbor building a fire, he can take that idea and build his own fire, and he hasn't taken anything from Ugg, you know? I thought that was a really kind of interesting insight, that ultimately all these laws that we have are really about figuring out ways to manage conflict. And that comes from, you know, that kind of Hoppean tradition, even though he's not, you know, Hoppe.
Well, that's right. And I mean, and Hoppe makes that point over and over again in his book. Like, it's a very prominent theme within his work that, again, if you have a sovereign right over your own body and over your own time, then if you've legally acquired a piece of property, or if you have, it's like kind of like the homesteading theory. If you have found an untilled piece of property and you utilize your time and your labor to till it, to make it productive, then you should own that. Nobody else has the right to take that from you. So yes, very similar to that. And Cody, since this was written in 1989, a lot of Hoppe's more inflammatory statements that he's made over the last several years are absent from this book. So it is a work of pure philosophy that even someone like you could agree with.
it's he's aged like a wine, but maybe not a fine one.
Yeah, or you know, or whiskey. You know, it gets a little bit more fiery.
Alex, don't tell us about what you're drinking. Tell us about how you're drinking it.
Okay, well, I am drinking Wild Turkey.
This episode is sponsored by.
Yes, go to libertarianchristians.com/shop. You can get all of our podcast merch, including this beautiful The Protestant Libertarian Pie. And I can't do the left and right thing with the camera. I'm not drunk, I promise. But you can get yourself a beautiful Protestant Libertarian podcast glass from which you can drink your whiskey or whatever other beverage you enjoy. So libertarianchristians.com/shop or libertarianchristians.com/store. They both work.
They both work because I had to make them work, Alex.
Yes, because I made a mistake on social media. But that's okay, Doug. Thank you for saving me.
Just throwing you under the bus. Oh my goodness.
What about you, Doug?
Yeah. So I have two books that were not like faith related, although one could be considered faith related. I'll go over that one first. I was going to hold up the books that I've read, but this one I read on, I listened to it. I did the audiobook. It's Letters to My Palestinian Neighbor by Yossi Klein Halevi. And I heard about him through Russ Roberts' podcast, Econ Talk. And of course, Russ Roberts moved to Israel in 2021. So he, you know, he used to be in the United States and he travels back and forth. Very, very popular, famous libertarian podcaster. And since October 7th, 2023, he has interviewed a number of academics, intellectuals, friends, possibly relatives, I don't know. And Yossi Halevi, Yossi Klein Halevi, he was on talking about the conflict in Israel. And I realize that right now there's a lot of ire headed to Israel's direction, right? As a state, it's behaving in ways that a lot of us are finding maybe either unconscionable or overreacting or maybe not doing due diligence. I realize that all of those statements, no matter who you are on the side, those could actually be debatable. And I have struggled to understand the proper way to analyze everything going on in Israel. However, one of the ways that I've been trying to do that is to sort of see both sides and read both sides. I could have listed for anybody listening to this two or three other books that were highly critical of Israel, and I'm reading them and thinking, oh, yeah, this is pretty bad. And then I'm reading something like this, Letters to My Palestinian Neighbor, and he is basically, it's written to a Palestinian, not like a particular person, but the idea of if an individual Palestinian were to read this, here's how I, as a Jew, as a Jewish person who is an Israeli national, would want you to here's what I would like you to listen to. That sounds really patronizing the way I'm putting that in my grammar, but he's basically saying, hey, I humbly want you to consider things from my side. And it's basically a pretty powerful and humble book, to be honest. And it seeks to have sort of a conversation with the Palestinians as opposed to simply, you know, demonizing them or sort of making excuses of like, you know, you hear some Israelites, defenders of Israel will say, well, they chose Hamas and that, well, that ends the story. We can do whatever, you know, Israel can do whatever they want. And that's really a shallow take on things. Basically I would say, and I've said this, in private to people, but I remember after October 7th, I had this thought, you know, people talked about, lived experience matters, right? That's kind of a woke agenda kind of thing. It's like, oh, well, the lived experience of Black people really matters. That only applies until you get to the Jews. And I think this is one effort in some sense. Now, this book was written prior to October, 2023. But I think this book in some sense tries to help people understand the lived experience of the Jews and those living in Israel, especially those of this generation who didn't, they weren't the ones who migrated there during the time where it was very contentious. That's one of the non-faith related books, although you could probably sort of make it faith adjacent.
I like it.
Excellent.
The other one is this one. Oh, this is tough.
Whoa, that is crazy.
The green
looking.
Screen. Yeah, the green screen is doing it because there's a lot of green in there. Yeah, this is like,
it's, hey, like it's a see-through book.
Yeah, it's almost like it is. Okay, so this is Peter Attia, The Science and Art of Longevity. Basically, this is such a good book. It's Rethinking Medicine to Live Better Longer. That's basically, you know, that is the subtitle. In an effort to become as healthy as Alex, this is where I started because I know Alex is a healthy guy. He likes to run.
Yep.
He likes to, he avoids certain types of food. And I'm like, how do you do this? Like when we were planning our trip to Vegas or to Memphis or whatever, for Freedom Fest, I was like, all these different things that you told me you needed. And I was like, wait, how do you even travel, man? Like,
yeah, it's really tough.
Whiskey, it can be tough, but, and until I sort of did a little bit of a foray into the idea of seed oils and some other things, which he doesn't really talk about seed oils. He talks about health from a, mostly a metabolic perspective. And, he talks about mostly the four horsemen of death, atherosclerotic disease, which is like cardiovascular and cerebrovascular cancer, neurodegenerative, which would be like Alzheimer's, dementia, and then foundational disease, which is like a spectrum of hyperinsulinemia to insulin resistance and fatty liver disease and type 2 diabetes. So he has like four major sections on that. And then he gets into like, well, what do you do? And one of the things that like really impacted me was traditional medicine, which he calls medicine 2.0. I forget why it's 2.0, but he's talking about what he hopes to be medicine 3.0. And the idea and the concept would be a lot of prevention through, in this case, diet and exercise, will prevent a lot of things that medicine 2.0 tends to not really pay attention to. It kind of falls through the cracks. And so, for example, being pre-diabetic sounds like, oh, wait, we identified somebody as pre-diabetic. Let's help them change to not be diabetic. Well, that's too late in his opinion. We could have gotten way earlier on in prevention, because a lot of these things, not for everybody, because there's genotypes and I'm probably using all the wrong words, but there's certain types of people who have certain genetic issues or variations and so forth that they can't just exercise their way out of something. But aside from that, for the most part, most of us can prevent ourselves from having type 2 diabetes and being pre-diabetic and doing that when you're 35 and never, ever getting diabetes. Alex, given what you eat, you're probably never going to get diabetes unless there's some, you know, genetic reason for you to somehow have it later in life or something like that. And so it's inspired me to think through medicine in a different way and start to make gradual changes to my diet. Sorry, Cody, I'm not going to go vegan. Gradual changes to my diet. And also focus on metabolic function and some of the things that actually make a difference. So in any case, to leave listeners with something more tangible, one way that really stuck with me is he talks about the centenarian Olympics, right? And so if you were 100, if you lived to be 100, what do you want to be able to do? And if it means pick up your great-grandchild, because hopefully by then you'll have great-grandchildren, right? And they weigh about 15 to 20 pounds, and lift them and put them on your lap. Like, if that's just something that you're like, hey, I really want to be able to do this when I'm 100. Well, what does that mean if you needed to, say, lift a kettlebell at the age of 40? Okay, 15 pounds and 100 means you're probably going to have to be able to lift, I'm just making the numbers up, 35-pound kettlebell to, like, lift it from the floor onto your lap. Like, he's not literally saying go do that exercise just so that when you're 100, but he's right. Trying to say the types of muscles and muscular development that you're going to need to be tended to now. Otherwise, it's gonna go. So the reason it's called Outlive is he basically is sort of advocating a like longevity approach to life, as opposed to just which he calls health span, as opposed to just lifespan. Because you know we can deter death in some sense, but you know if you're gonna live to be 100, would you like your 90s to be actually enjoyable, or would you rather? What would you like to do? So it's kind of a like, hey, how can we live as healthy as long as possible? And then when the health deteriorates, it's probably going to be rapid. Like that would be kind of the ideal in a sense for him. So anyway, Outlive by Peter Attia. If you want to get a sense of him, if you have a Disney Plus subscription, it might even be on like a National Geographic website or whatever. He did he was the main doctor on, it's called Limitless with Chris Hemsworth. He did like 6 episodes of like body endurance kind of stuff that were like all health related reasons. And Peter Attia is featured in that. You kind of get a sense for him on that.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. I probably talk way too long.
Oh no, I could anyway. Go on and talk about holistic health. I'm all sure day you long.
Could. Yeah, no, we're hoping, sure. Alex, we're hoping that we can get a certain guest on to talk about this, not Peter Attia, to talk about these things. Cause there's these people who I've begun to go down the rabbit hole of healthy eating and like whole foods and things like that. And I'm not really great at it. Like we've gotten rid of seed oils. I now use, beef tallow to cook with. But it's like, man, I really want to know what this person buys when they go to the grocery store or when they travel, what do they choose to eat? Like, do they like, I mean, these people that I'm thinking about, they have means. And so they probably choose really nice places to eat, but like, what do they do? Cause they're definitely not going to Taco Bell.
Right. Yep.
That's enough about that. I won't keep going on about those.
Listen, I'll sit here and impugn Hans Hermann Hoppe all day, but I'm not going to let you talk crap about Taco Bell. That's just not going to sit well with me.
I think the last time I had Taco Bell, I was maybe 9.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
It was probably about a week ago for me.
Oh man. Okay, Cody. We're going to have a different episode with you, but it'll be completely private and just for you, man. Just for you. I don't proclaim to be the beacon of good health. I have my own journey. I'm on my own journey, as they might say. But I will say that I have most of the time, I don't crave the kinds of things that I used to eat. And that's actually evidence that I'm going in the right direction.
So. Yes. I think once you start, you just won't have a desire for that. And if you eat it again, you'll wind up feeling really, really bad. I mean, I pretty much gave up my only bad health habit is whiskey. And even then I don't like drink it during the week or anything like that, except for when I'm trying to represent our brand to make money. There you go for our show. obvious ploy to,
by the way, Alex doesn't actually make any money on off this. We haven't, we haven't made any sorts of arrangements in that way. So this is totally an LCI. It's not a donation.
It's the snowball effect. But you know, there are very easy and simple steps that people can take to better health. And I think, again, it just starts with maybe cutting out one or two things, or maybe adding one or two things. Water is a huge component of holistic health. Like if you can just drink like a gallon of water a day, that alone will make a huge difference in your life. And that's something that's very realistic for anyone to do.
And I was going to say, Alex, when you say when you eat the stuff you used to eat, it makes you sick. So it sounds like your body is weaker and mine is stronger because I can eat Taco Bell and it doesn't bother me. Is that the takeaway?
Well, I'm not sure if your body should be able to. I mean, the human body has this incredible ability to adapt under stress.
Yeah, that's true. All right.
But you know, if we're going to have a competitive eating contest, yes, Cody, you would be the king of that, right? You would dominate. Like the Joey Chestnut of the Libertarian Christian Institute.
I don't know that reference at all.
Oh, he's the hot dog eating king.
Yeah, the hot dog guy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Got it. Yeah.
Joey Chestnut.
I love that guy. Well, do you know, it was funny. This is a side note here. On hot dog eating contests, when anybody talks about it, you know who I think of is Jonah Goldberg, because he's really like good at it.
Really?
Interesting.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Huh. All right. I'm going to switch gears to the faith-related ones that we've talked about or that we've read. And I will tell you that episode 380 was an interview with Miranda Zipporah-Cruz. Oh, here it is. Sorry. Faithful Politics, 10 Approaches to Christian Citizenship and Why It Matters. It almost became the book we were going to read this month, which is October, for the LCI Book Club, which you should all join. We are going to read, I'll talk about the next book here in a second, that we're going to read. So Miranda does this really great job of having basically 10 different approaches to politics, right? And it's from the spectrum from like not very much engagement at all, like the Amish, to like heavy engagement in the sense of like theonomists and Christian nationalists and there's variations in that spectrum. And so if you want to get the gist of it, listen to the episode or watch the episode. It's episode 380 and it's called Faithful Politics. And we actually have a slide about, I don't know, halfway through that we cover for about 20 minutes and we go over these in particular. So it's like really kind of really good teaching opportunity. It's very educational, helps you kind of get your head around, and I was trying to mix two metaphors at once there. How do different people across the spectrum of Christian politics relate to the state? And she's not like anti-libertarian or anything like that. She has a few comments in it about freedom and from a Christian view, and a freedom from a sort of American libertarian-ish kind of view. And she doesn't see them very compatible. I challenged her a little bit on the episode about that, but it's an excellent book. I was thoroughly impressed.
Yep. And it was a great interview too. You did an awesome job talking with her.
Oh, thanks. That's really why I wanted to share this, so that you guys would compliment me.
The accolades.
Yep. Well, Cody, what about you, man?
I'll throw in a couple, because I think I've got a couple more on my list than you do. So I'm going to try to catch up a little bit. The two I'll mention are both kind of in the Anabaptist wing. Doug, you had said that I don't read a lot of fiction, but I did include a graphic novel that is kind of nonfiction oriented. And it's called By Water, the Felix Manns Story. And it follows off an early Anabaptist who broke off from Zwingli's movement. The art is actually really cool because it's inspired by medieval illustration and like Hieronymus Bosch style stuff. So kind of weird, creepy monsters and demons and things like that. So the look of it is just really just excellent and super creepy. The story can be a little bit hard to follow if you don't already know a little of the history, but there's a helpful timeline in the back. So if you get a hold of the graphic novel, start in the back, read the timeline, then go back and read the graphic novel. But it's really good. It's put out by Plow, which is kind of a largely like Anabaptist kind of publisher. Another book that they put out, which is less on the kind of popular graphic novel side, but one I read in preparation for a kind of Anabaptist systematic theology I've been writing, is Peter Riedemann's Hutterite Confession of Faith. Riedemann was an early Anabaptist theologian of the Hutterite movement. And Hutterites, they practiced voluntary communal ownership of property, which I don't necessarily agree with. So I didn't expect...
But it's voluntary, Cody.
It is voluntary. That's true. But it's just not necessarily my cup of tea, right? So I didn't necessarily expect to connect so much with Riedemann because of that, because it sounds, you know, kind of hippie or whatever. But I have to say, he's just like an excellent theologian, especially for, you know, a cobbler who spent most of his time in prison. Although perhaps you could argue that in one sense that placed him closer to Jesus than the university educated theologians of his day. But Riedemann is just, I think especially his stuff on union with Christ and some of the stuff he's had to say about the Lord's Supper was just really excellent, really connected to that union with Christ stuff in a really kind of profound way. So his confession of faith that he wrote from a Hutterite perspective, by water, the Felix Mann story, both Anabaptist resources, very different, but I would recommend.
All right, Alex.
Yep. The first one that comes to mind, the interview will be out by the time this episode comes out, but it is with a New Testament scholar. The book is written by a New Testament scholar from Pittsburgh Theological Seminary named Tucker Ferda, and it's called Jesus and His Promised Second Coming. And in the book, he analyzes historically whether or not the idea of the second coming goes back to Jesus. And so he has a really interesting review of the history of this concept at the beginning of his book. And he makes the claim that really up until the Enlightenment, basically every Christian just simply assumed that when Jesus talked about a second coming, those were actually the words of Jesus instead of the words of the early church imposed back upon Jesus in the gospel. Mm. But then there was this massive shift in the way that people thought about Jesus in the second coming during the Enlightenment. And it goes back to even before like Romarus and the first quest for the historical Jesus, where people began to believe that Jesus just couldn't have predicted his own second coming. And so Ferda argues that that's actually not the case based on the evidence that we have in the New Testament, and that the most likely reading of the historical evidence that we have is that Jesus did in fact predict his second coming. He spends a lot of time talking about how Jewish eschatology in the first century was always conceived as a form of a process. So there was never this idea within Judaism that God was just going to act like that and everything and everything, the new heavens and the new earth were just going to be ushered in. It was going to be a process that often included conflict, and that Jesus fits very well within that set of eschatological understandings. And so he asked the question, why have scholars basically completely ignored this question up until now? And he tries to bring a lot of the evidence back into his reading of the New Testament. And he says, I think pretty conclusively in his book, or he determines pretty conclusively in his book, that Jesus did in fact believe that he was going to die and then come again. And that was not just an invention of the early church. A really, really good book, work of historical scholarship.
How did the interview go?
Awesome. He was an incredible guy, really nice. So he's writing some more stuff now. So he's definitely someone I want to have back on my show in the future. He was a great guy.
Cool.
I was going to say, when you were talking about that, it made me think of kind of one aspect of liberal criticism that you sometimes hear. Well, they're sort of say, well, Jesus expected the world to end right away and it didn't end. And so, ha, 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 obviously they were wrong and Christianity is a false religion. And then on the other side of their mouth, they'll say, oh, well, you know, all those prophecies that Jesus had about the world ending, where they were about the temple. And actually those were written after the temple was destroyed in the 70 AD and put in Jesus's mouth. And it's okay, well, which one is it? Like, right. Did Jesus predict this and he was wrong, or is it, or was he right? And so that's why he couldn't have predicted it.
Right.
So yeah, they have a little bit of a catch 22 there. But yeah, that's great.
Yeah. No, and well, and what's funny about, to your point, Cody, too, is he has a really interesting chapter on like the reason why a lot of modern scholars have just assumed that Jesus couldn't have done that. And he said a lot of it's based on very anti-Semitic views of Jewish eschatology in the first century, that there have been like a lot of Protestant scholars that assumed that Jews were waiting for this kingly Messiah who would ride into Jerusalem and then slay all of Israel's enemies, and that Jesus obviously didn't believe in that. So he couldn't have fit within Jewish eschatological expectations. And so it's kind of that history within Protestant Christianity, in particular, of trying to divorce Jesus from his Jewish context, that even though since the 1970s, biblical scholarship has moved on from that, this is kind of like this particular issue is like a hang on from that period, that scholars never really got past that attachment to the idea that Jesus couldn't have just fit within Jewish eschatology.
Most bad theology stems from anti-Semitism.
No, I mean, when it comes to Jesus, I would say, yeah, a lot of it does, for sure.
I mean, sort of tongue in cheek, but also that's still true. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say German Protestant liberals, but
yes.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Did you just repeat what I said? Or
yeah. The Lutherans.
All right.
I was confirmed in a Lutheran church. I love the Lutherans, by the way. I worked in a Lutheran church for a long time, grew up in one. So, you know.
Well, now that you've cleared your throat, I've been feeling bad if I've offended anybody who's a Hoppe fan. Because I think in one sense, I feel like the only real libertarian in LCI, because I'm the only one who's willing to just completely split apart everybody and not try to build the coalition.
Right. Yeah. Only in your praxeology, maybe not your orthodoxy.
But truly, Hoppe's got a lot of good stuff. But some things weird bother me a little bit. If you hear me say something inflammatory, just know that I don't speak for LCI. I'm only speaking for myself.
Yeah. And if I say something inflammatory, I am speaking for LCI and not for myself.
Alex probably is. If it's me or Jacob, probably not. But if it's Alex,
my, oh my, oh my.
That's why you should go buy our merch. So All right. Anyways, Doug, what's next on your list?
Well, okay. So I had this book that is going to be terrible because I was like, wait, I don't even know if I can actually review the plot line. I'm just going to tell you my favorite novel of the year. It's it might have been out last year. Actually, it was out last year. Justin Cronin, The Ferryman. I don't know if anybody read Justin Cronin's first books. It was called The Passage. It was written about 10 years ago, and it was the first in a series of three. And in The Passage, I got 50% of the way through and realized that this was a vampire novel. Didn't even notice it because it was so well written, and it wasn't quite what you expect about vampire. It was like government experiment gone wrong, genetic stuff, all of that. And and then I read the rest of the series. He actually wrote another book that was in a totally different genre. The end of the storyline and plot summary didn't really interest me. But when The Ferryman came out, I was like, oh, I got to get this. And this book is so fascinating because the main character, this takes place on this like set of islands. And the main character is a ferryman that ferries people from what you could call in sort of like there's euphemisms going on in the way that the story is written. There you could call from like death to life, but in a sense, those people are reincarnated and brought back to the island. And so I realize that that's like really super simplistic view of what this is, but there is sort of a meta narrative happening with all of this that I didn't see coming. But then once it started, some things started to get revealed. You're just like, oh my goodness, this is better on a whole other level. And the writing is just phenomenal. It took me, I don't know, a week or two to read it because I was just so engrossed in it. And, I have kids and I have responsibilities in life, so I don't just get through a novel in a weekend, as much as I would like to. So, The Ferryman by Justin Cronin, it's a fiction book. There's no political message in it at all that I can find. I recommend it to some other people and all of them have told me that they just absolutely love it. So if you're looking for fiction reading, absolutely The Ferryman, probably my favorite fiction book in the last year and a half.
Cody, what do
you
got?
Guys read any fiction? Alex, do you read any fiction? Cody said he kind of did. I don't know if Anabaptist history counts as fiction, but
over the last couple of years with my daughter, we still read to her at night, even though she's getting a little bit older, just because it's like a fun family thing to do. But we read the Narnia series, we've read the Harry Potter series, and now we're working on Lord of the Rings, which has been awesome. So we just finished up The Hobbit, but that's pretty much the only fiction that I read.
Yeah. Okay.
If I do, sometimes I'll get into sci-fi a little bit. F. Paul Wilson's series I started reading again, starting with An Enemy of the State. I think I mentioned that the last time we met up.
Yeah.
And I've got the rest of them, but I just haven't got a chance to read them yet. We homeschool our kids, so we just started, my daughter just started Tom Sawyer, but I've been kind of participating a little bit and helping along the way with that. But yeah, I like some fiction.
You like audiobooks, right, Cody?
I do, just because it's easier because I'm
when so I'm is she listening to the Tom Sawyer books?
No, she's reading mostly.
Okay. Yeah,
she's reading it.
Can I make a recommendation that you download the Nick Offerman readings?
Okay.
Nick Offerman is the narrator for a lot of, who's the author of Tom Sawyer?
Oh, Mark Twain?
Mark Twain. Sorry, I was going to say Samuel Clemens, which I know is his real name. Mark Twain. He's a huge Mark Twain fan and all of that. So and did it's just say, so cool to listen to Nick Offerman read it.
Did you say the expletives?
Ooh, I don't remember.
It's kind of, I imagine Ron Swanson in my head going, the N-word.
Yeah, no. I think he reads it. I don't think.
Yeah.
And yeah, no, I don't know. I think he utters it.
Okay.
Good recommendation. It got my daughter, because she was reading Huckleberry Finn, and then I told her about this, and she goes, ooh, because she knows him from Nick Offerman and Amy Poehler did this two-season thing called Making It. Was like all about, it was so weird. It was all about crafting and like a competition of like making these like really cool crafts. And so our kid, it was kind of fun for kids. And so my kids know who he is and they know his voice and all of that. And so to hear him read it, it's kind of fun.
Yeah, I started on Sawyer because I know it kind of came first, I believe, but it's also, it feels a little more kid-friendly. I thought we'd kind of build up to Huckleberry Finn. But,
yeah. Introduce your kids to racist ideas slowly. Speaking of, I'm just going to make that a really weird pivot to what do you not recommend, Cody? Because I know what's on your list.
Oh, yeah. Here we go.
Yeah, I only have really one on my list that I would just totally not recommend. Depending on... If you're looking for something to read just for enjoyment, I wouldn't necessarily recommend it. It was like, if you want to understand the cultural moment, like I held off on this one for a few years because it was kind of big in 2020 and I finally just went, okay, I'll read it. But Ibram X. Kendi's How to Be an Anti-Racist is kind of an interesting, I guess, foil, I guess, for Hughes's book, because Kendi is all about race preferences and policies and seeing every disparity where white people are better situated.
Yep, the only solution to past discrimination is present discrimination.
There you go. Yeah, and also, any time you have any disparity where white people are in any way better situated, that's de facto evidence of racism. If you have a disparity where, you know, black people do better, well, that doesn't really mean anything. But and I think that kind of plays into kind of his narrative that any kind of, like, you know, social or cultural critique that you might make about sort of, you know, black Americans in general is necessarily racist, because the only reason there could be any kind of problem has to be just like explicit racism, right? And so one example, so he recalls, like, with great embarrassment in the book, this high school speech that he made where he criticized aspects of black American culture, and he now sees that as an example of him having internalized racism, and he's victim blaming, right? But he also recalls with far less embarrassment this theory he had in college as an adult, that white people were aliens from outer space who lacked normal human empathy. And so that gives you kind of a sense of his current state of mind, that if you have anything kind of critical to say about just like a culture, you know, not actually like a racist attitude, but like a, you know, like a racist idea, but like a culture, that's racist. But saying, you know, well, you know, white people might be aliens from outer space, that's not really like racist or anything. It's just, right. You know, just kind of a silly thing that
which
I thought.
Which is funny, because like back in the early 2000s when when Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell were lying us into war in Iraq, we would call that kind of mentality just racist, like just plain old racist. Now, back then, everyone could get us into war. It didn't matter what your skin color was.
I don't know, man. I think right now anybody can get us into war.
That's true. But it's only bad when the white people do it. Right,
or if the orange person does it,
because Donald Trump is definitely not white. I don't know what his skin color is, but it's not the same as mine.
All right, Cody, you have a few more on your list here. In brief, what have you read? And then I want to switch to what's on our list to, like, what are we looking forward to reading here soon? Because we are wrapping up the end of 2024. I'm sure we want to clear our shelves so that we can get a lot of books for Christmas or something.
Yeah, I mean, I'll mention a couple quick ones. Losing Our Religion by Russell Moore, I read. Moore narrates his journey to ideological homelessness after the Southern Baptists, his denomination, first silenced dissent over Trump, and then silenced victims of sexual abuse from Southern Baptist pastors. And some are going to kind of poo-poo anything conservatives who let the movement over Donald Trump have to say. And I get that to some extent. Like, you know, there were a lot of things that conservatives were willing to accept before Trump, and then, you know, it was just a kind of the bombacity of Trump just sort of too much for them, right? But, you know, as somebody who feels politically and theologically homeless myself much of the time, I appreciate a lot of what he had to say. I think I would just bring it into conversation with libertarianism and Christian anarchism. That's maybe what's missing a little bit. But a lot of his critiques of kind of our cultural moment, I think, are valid. I also threw in a couple books by Nijagupta, one as an editor, one as an author. Sin and Its Remedy in Paul was really interesting. That's when he's editor of that one. It's a collection of essays from theologians on how Paul approached sin in his various letters. A particular interest to me was Paul's discussion of sin in Romans as being like kind of like a personal force or entity that enslaves us, which I thought was kind of really helpful for an article I wrote about the dispute between Rosaria Butterfield and Preston Sprinkle about whether being same-sex attracted is a sin. And the last one by Gupta was Paul in the Language of Faith. That's his sort of study of the word pistis in Greek. Fantastic. Or faith, and its use in Paul's cultural context to develop how Paul used the word and how we should best translate it. The short takeaway from that is that trust is kind of the key idea in the nominal form, but as a verb, it mostly means like believe, and as an adjective, it usually means faithful. And so you kind of have this range here that it could kind of, you know, fit into. So you have to sort of pay attention to that when you're translating.
Yes. Mm. And for anyone listening, I believe it'll be the second Thursday in November. I just preached a sermon this past Sunday where I used Nijagupta's framework for translating faith as the foundation of my sermon. I talk about this a lot. So this should be out about the time this episode comes out too. I think
you can only get away with that as a Methodist. If you're Reformed, you couldn't preach that sermon.
Oh, no, for sure. But again, I go to an Anglican church, so we're all good. Wesleyanism, we're okay with.
We're mostly Pelagians.
Right.
All right. So go.
Okay. Hold on. Let me just mark off
not semi-Pelagian.
Let me mark on our off on our checklist.
Mostly Pelagian, 90%
under the bus. Thanks, Cody. So we have our jab at the Hoppians, our jab at the Reformed, jab at the Lutherans.
I think that was a jab at Methodist. I don't think that was a jab at the Reform.
Yeah.
Whatever. All right. What are you guys looking forward to reading? I'll go first here because I have things actually on my list. So it's on my Kindle, so I can't show it to you by holding it up because it would be kind of weird. Although I do have the cover thing. Invisible Jesus by Scott McKnight and Tommy Preston Phillips just came out last week as of this recording. I think it's about leaving the church and finding Jesus, which if you can guess what that subtitle is meant to declare, it's all about those who are deconstructing. They take a very positive view of what deconstructors are doing because the statistics on that is that most of them want to follow Jesus and stay Christian in a certain sense. They just are fed up with the church. And the book so far, I'm about 60% of the way through because it's really engaging. It's really good. It's enlightening in the sense that they have a lot of statistics, but they also have a lot of stories and interviews of people that they've spoken to. And I think a lot of times the deconstruction movement, in many ways for good reason, like understandable reasons, has sort of been thrown under the bus because you have certain personalities. Cody, you don't need to mention them because I know you know who I'm talking about. that just like make deconstruction just look bad. And there's a lot of people who are out there generally speaking on the streets, genuinely wanting to maintain a relationship with Jesus, maintain a relationship with God, follow the scriptures, but also it just can't stand the church. And I think in some sense, a lot of us can understand that. And I don't think the solution is to say, well, you just need to get over yourself and be, you know, part of a community and whatever. And so that's part of what this is about. Other book is, and Cody, I know you're really happy for me, somebody who's like a little more postmodern in my thinking. Kevin Van Hooser's Mere Christian Hermeneutics, Transfiguring What It Means to Read the Bible Theologically. I'm only just a little bit into it so far. It's really good. I've got Progressive Myths by Michael Humer. Hopefully I can get him to come on the show. I Came to Cast Fire, An Introduction to Rene Girard. I just learned about this. Apparently this isn't published until like November, which is, I guess, around the time this is going to go. But I'm always interested in introductions to Rene Girard because he's hard to understand. And then this thick book, Brothers Karamazov, Michael Katz translation. I tried reading this book like 8 years ago. I got like third of the way through and I was like, I just can't. This is too hard to read. I texted a friend. And I was like, I can't read this Dostoevsky. And he's like, yeah, this Russian stuff is hard. I started reading this and this is like I would say not a breeze in one sense, but like it is not hard to read. And it's not like reading Eugene Peterson's version of translating Dostoevsky. This is like an actual, genuine, good translation. It's very rich with allusions and I'm not trying to downplay Eugene Peterson, but it's not like it's a kid version, a young reader's version.
The first Bible I ever read was The Message. And if that's where you're at right now in your faith journey, then God bless you. We love you and we are here for you.
I like how Doug, you tried to silence me from offending somebody that you just want to Eugene Peterson. All right.
Oh, I can't leave all the offensive comments to you, man.
All right. I can mention one real quick that's on my list. We could let Alex wrap it up. Yeah. So one I just got because there was this great sale on, who's the publisher?
Was it Ehrman's or IDP?
Ehrman's had this, and it might still be going on. There's excellent, well, maybe if you're listening now, probably not. But they had this great sale on pretty much their whole catalog. And so this one was on my list. It had been kind of expensive. But it's called The End of Theological Education by Ted Smith. And I haven't read it yet, so I don't know exactly what it's going to be. But I've been really interested in thinking about what the future of theological education might be. It's like on the one hand, I do think there's like value in having educated church leaders and theologians. But I also see the excesses, you know, out-of-touch academics who serve elite left-wing postmodern ideas more than the church. So I also think that our model of church leadership, which strongly differentiates laity and clergy, is unbiblical and keeps Christians immature. So, perhaps a future where, due to maybe the wide availability of internet content, the average churchgoer is far more knowledgeable about the Bible and theology and church history, I think would be an improvement over the old order where you kind of have one guy who's sort of the gatekeeper for all the Christian knowledge. So I don't know yet exactly how Smith is going to answer some of these questions, but it's a topic that I've been thinking about a lot because I really don't know what the future of academia is and what that's going to mean for the church. I could see some negative things coming out of it, but I'm also hopeful about a future that is a little more egalitarian, I suppose.
So basically the guy who spent 5 hours on YouTube might actually know just as much as the guy who took a class in seminary.
Depends on where he took it. Yeah.
Yep. It's true, though. It's true.
All right, Alex. I don't see anything on our list, but I think I added this a little bit later in our creation of this document. What are you looking forward to reading? It's likely to also mean pitching new episodes you're gonna be doing in the future.
Yes. Okay. So I am starting to fall back down the historical Jesus research rabbit hole, which was something I was very interested in about 8 or 9 years ago, and just because of life circumstances, couldn't really follow up with. But I just I'm setting up the book that I'm going to read next. It's very important. I just got done reading a really great book by Craig Blomberg called Jesus the Purifier, which is an excellent review of all three quests for the historical Jesus. And essentially, Blomberg argues at the end of his book that John can be utilized as a historical source for understanding Jesus as he was in history. And he says that if there's going to be another quest for the historical Jesus, then it has to integrate John as a legitimate source for historical information regarding Jesus. On the flip side of that, I just got in the mail.
Evangelicals rejoice, right?
Well, yes. But here's where it's going to be really interesting. On the flip side of that, I just got an advanced copy of a new book that's going to be published on Eerdmans here in a month or two called The Next Quest for the Historical Jesus, which is edited by James Crossley and Chris Keith, both of whom I have a lot of respect for and really like their work. But it is a collection of articles that is designed to try to trigger the next phase of historical Jesus research. James Crossley, very interestingly enough, comes out of an explicitly Marxist tradition. And so the entire project is designed to try to bring historical Jesus research in line with what is happening in humanities departments around the country. So there are a lot of articles by various scholars in there. A lot of them go in different directions. So they're not all based on this Marxist tradition, but they're trying to pose new questions about the historical Jesus and maybe reframe some of the assumptions that historical Jesus researchers have had. The book looks really, really interesting. I think that maybe there are like 20 or 25 contributors in the book. So I'm really excited to go through that. I've been wanting to have James Crossley on my show for a long time, and I think that this is going to be the way that I'll be able to get him on. But it does seem like just between Blomberg's work and Crossley's work, like there might be a forthcoming division within historical Jesus research between maybe more evangelical oriented people that accept John as a historical source, and then kind of like next questers, which are going in an entirely different direction that might be influenced by Marxist theory. So I'm very interested to see how all of that develops. Apparently Eerdmans has a lot of books coming up in the next year or so on historical Jesus research that I'm going to be reading and reviewing and hopefully getting some interviews for. So I'm looking forward to seeing, because it does seem like there is right now a massive turning point within Jesus research. So I'm 100% committed to riding that train as far as it goes. So
cool. Well, I'm waiting on the release of the final quest for the historical Jesus. That way I don't have to read all the stuff.
I think that's the one when he comes back. And then he just tells us.
or it's when we finally have a time machine and we can go meet him.
Yes.
Or something. I don't know. Oh, I wonder if that's how the... Never mind.
Yep.
I'll leave it at that. Hey, guys, thanks for joining us. Joining me. Thanks for joining us. Awesome. Thanks for joining me for this. I love having this conversation with you because I like to know what you're all reading. And this has been great.
Yep. Thank you, Doug. It's been good joining y'all.
Yeah. Always great talking with you guys. Again, libertarianchristians.com/shop or libertarianchristians.com/store. Buy our
merch. What can they get?
They can get this
glass. Without the whiskey.
There you go. Without the whiskey. And then merch for all of our shows. Great place to go.
All right. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast. If you liked today's episode, we encourage you to rate us on Apple Podcasts to help expand our audience. If you want to reach out to us, email us at podcast@libertarianchristians.com. You can also reach us at LCI Official on Twitter. And of course, we are on Facebook and have an active group you are welcome to join. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Libertarian Christian Podcast is a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute, a registered 501c3 nonprofit. If you'd like to find out more about LCI, visit us on the web at libertarianchristians.com. The voiceovers are by Matt Bellis and Catherine Williams. As of episode 115, our audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.
Hello everyone, it's Doug from the Libertarian Christian Podcast. You might notice already that this recording sounds quite a bit different from usual. In fact, it probably sounds pretty crappy. Well, I'm doing this to show you something pretty amazing. As you might know, the guys over at Podsworth Media have been producing my show for several years, quite a while, hundreds of episodes. And now they have a brand new online app for taking rough recordings like this one and making them sound a whole lot cleaner and a lot more listenable in just a few easy clicks. So here are some of the core features. They remove background noise. It reduces plosives, which is really handy for me because I often forget to put my pop filter on before I do a YouTube video. Because pop filters look terrible when you're on camera. It fixes clipping. It removes clicks and pops. It evenly levels dialogue so that you don't have somebody talking really quietly and then somebody talking really loud because they're too close to the mic or too far away from the mic. How do you use it? It's easy. You go to podsworth.com, you click get started, and because you're a listener to one of the Libertarian Christian Institute's podcasts, you can get 50% off your first order by entering the promo code LCI50. That's LCI50, and you will get 50% off your first order. If you are doing anything like a podcast, a video, a sermon, an audiobook, anything that's spoken word, you want to use podsworth.com and clean up your audio to be even more professional and polished.